Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Dave Barry, whose latest novel is Insane City. This is the 13th work of fiction. There are nonfiction books. However, this is only the third novel that is just Dave Barry without a collaboration. There's Tricky Business and Big Trouble. Dave Barry also has written columns for Miami Herald?
Yeah.
Are you back to doing that again or no?
Occasionally. Like last summer, I went to the Olympics in London, and I wrote daily columns from there. And I went to the political conventions, wrote daily columns from there. And I do occasionally other columns, but I don't write regularly anymore.
Well, I did notice that you had a very, very big column, an end-of-the-year column, which was pretty funny.
I do that every year. It's the hardest thing I do, but people like it. I have to go through the year and try to turn it into humor.
The last time I talked to you was for a collection of essays. You said you had started writing this book. What brought you back to writing a comic novel?
I had one of those moments where you're not really looking for something to write a book about, but a book, kind of a nugget of an idea pops in your mind. I was attending a wedding at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel on Key Biscayne, which is a beautiful hotel, overlooking the water, and the wedding gazebo overlooks the water. And Key Biscayne happens to be a place where occasionally rafters come ashore in Miami, either Cubans or Haitians for the most part, but people arriving in boats. And it's this beautiful, perfectly planned wedding. I thought, what would happen if a raft came ashore right now during this wedding? What would the result be? I don't know why that came into my mind, but that really was the first idea that I had that led to writing in this book. It was kind of more of a serious idea than a funny one.
What happened at that point? You're going, well, who's in the wedding?
Who's in the wedding? Yeah, they'd be all the questions you have to ask if you're going to have a story. Who's in the wedding and who's in the boat? And I decided the wedding couple would be a mismatched couple. He's like a kind of a loser, slacker. He tweets for a living. He's a tweeter. Social media professional, we should say. And there are such people. I mean, and then she's the, you know, type A, beautiful blonde, wealthy, driven Washington attorney. And so she's kind of running the show. The other question was, who's in the raft? Because if it's Cubans in Miami, there's no story. They can just stay because they're fleeing political oppression and the law says they can stay. So I decided they would be Haitians, because if Haitians come to Miami by boat, they have to go. If they're caught, they have to leave. So they kind of have to sneak ashore and find – there's a large Haitian community in Miami. So that became kind of my idea. What if – you know? And then I decided to have it be not during the wedding but before the wedding, and it's the groom who's the slacker who doesn't care about causes and is just not a serious person who ends up rescuing this Haitian woman and her two kids – and thus becoming responsible for them because they don't want him to turn them over to the authorities. So he ends up taking them into his hotel suite. And that's sort of the heart of the plot, which I realize doesn't sound funny at all, but that is the heart of the plot. He's the dilemma he's got. He's never had to do the right thing. He's never had to make a moral decision in his life. And suddenly he's confronted one, and it's messing up his bride's perfect, perfect wedding.
At this point, of course, you haven't written a damn thing.
No, right. Exactly.
Right, okay. As you're beginning to assemble it, since you hadn't done it in a while, is the process kind of similar? You suddenly figure out the characters. For instance, it struck me at the beginning, you have our hero, Seth Weinstein, coming to the wedding by plane, and he's got his three friends, Marty, Kevin, and Big Steve. And my thought is, these are the main characters. Yet, as it turns out, Kevin and Steve virtually vanish. At the beginning, were these going to be the main characters?
No, I wasn't trying to write The Hangover 2, you know.
Okay.
So I wanted them to be there because they're funny and, you know, they can be part of the story. But I knew that the groom was going to be the main character. I knew the bride was going to be a main character because it's their wedding. I kind of knew how it was going to end, but I didn't know who else was going to get it there. So a couple of other people pop up. There's a woman named Cindy who Seth runs into at the Clevelander Bar in his first night. She's in the Miss Amateur Hot Bod competition at the Clevelander Bar. I don't know if you've ever been to the Clevelander Bar.
No, I haven't.
It's this legendary South Beach bar that has nothing to do with Cleveland. And Elmore Leonard once told me that this will happen to you when you write fiction. Right. You'll have a character and you'll say, okay, this is your role, you're doing this. And the character goes, oh, no, I'm a bigger character than that. And they kind of steal the scene, then they steal another scene. And that's what Cindy became. She became more and more important to the plot, ultimately very important to the plot. And that I didn't expect at all.
Yeah, it seemed to me in reading the first half of the book that at some point the wedding would happen and they'd deal with it. And I assumed that you kind of figured that would go on.
Nope. The one thing I did know was how I intended to end it. I wanted it to end in a way that you, the reader, was not ready for. So that I knew. How to get there was the hard part, but that I knew.
And the snake handler just popped up, too.
Well, now, yeah, I have a snake guy named Dwayne, who is a snake guy. There are such people in Miami. There are guys who walk around the city in tourist areas like South Beach or Bayside Market or Lincoln Road who have on around their necks these albino pythons. We have a lot of pythons in Miami, way more than we need. We have an infestation, in fact. They walk around with these pythons, and sometimes it's so they can pose with tourists to get a picture of a guy with a snake. I don't really think there's a big demand for that, but they did. But I think sometimes it's just, like, for them a fashion accessory. They like to walk around with a big snake, which has always seemed a little creepy to me. But anyway, I made one of the main characters a snake guy.
So you've kind of started there, and then, of course, in order to exaggerate further, you're going to make Tina Clark, her father, as rich as he can be, but obviously not rich enough.
Right, because in his world, nobody's ever rich enough.
Which brings in the group of 12 and group of 6 and probably group of 3 and
right.
Whatever down the road. But on the other hand, those groups do exist, groups of millionaires who are doing that, and you do wonder maybe they're playing pinochle.
Well, yeah, there was actually kind of an inspiration in real life for that. I once spoke at a group called the Young Presidents Organization, YPO. And basically it's guys who are running companies, and they're young guys, and they're very successful guys. But they feel like they have to get together and be successful. But after a while, at least my impression of it was, it really wasn't that exciting just sitting around with guys when that's the – it's like Mensa. You know, to Mensa people? Like, I know you're really smart, you know, and you can pass all the tests and everything, but why are you just getting around, sitting around being smart? I mean, what is the joy in that? So, yeah, I talk about this guy who's the father of the – who's a billionaire and who belongs – it was actually the group of 11 he belongs to, 11 billionaires who get together and do what billionaires do, which I personally don't really know what they do. But I have Mike essentially saying that he sits around and talks about his helicopters with the other guys, the other billionaires. But his goal, the goal of all of them is to get in an even more exclusive group called the Group of 6. And that becomes a subplot in the wedding, because he's invited a guy he thinks is in a group of 6 to the wedding and wants very much to impress this guy. And the fact that Seth manages to screw up the wedding very badly makes a lot of tension between Mike and his future son-in-law.
And by throwing in marijuana and everybody getting stoned, everything gets thrown out. It goes wild.
Yeah, Seth's parents, Rose and Sid, they show up with and it comes from California. They show up with a big container of marijuana-laced brownies, which are medically required for all the conditions they decide they have. And these accidentally get served at the rehearsal dinner, which is sort of sets in motion a chain of events.
How did the marijuana idea come to you, remember?
Well, I wanted a way for the rehearsal dinner to sort of open up and for funny things to happen. And I had this character, Wendell Corliss, the member of the group of 6, who's like this super famous venture capitalist, captain of industry, serious guy. And I had this guy, Marty, who was Seth's best man, who was a complete slacker. And I wanted them to have a relation. I wanted them to talk, because I had this conversation in my mind between the slacker and the billionaire. And I wanted a way for them to just open up freely to each other. That's where the idea of having the marijuana brownies served. They get hungry, and they discover that there is a pizza place on Key Biscayne, but it doesn't deliver. And so Wendell Corliss, the captain of industry, not realizing it, that he's high as a kite, decides that the solution should be to buy the pizza restaurant. So they buy a pizza restaurant to order a pizza, basically.
What happens, of course, is each time something happens, it escalates into something else. And this is, I guess, the same pattern that Elmore Leonard uses, that Donald Westlake blew everybody out of the water with.
Yeah, you, and that's exactly right. When you get a situation and you think, all you're thinking as a plotter, I mean, you kind of know where you're going ultimately in the book, but in this scene you're thinking, what would make it worse? What could make it even worse than this? What else could go wrong here? What's the most wrong thing that could happen here? So let's say you have an orangutan steals the wedding ring. What else could happen with the orangutan that would be even worse than that?
He'd swallow it. Well, I don't think he does. But
no, he doesn't swallow it.
No,
but
he doesn't swallow it.
We should point out there actually
he
is an orangutan. And that was another character, by the way. There's an orangutan named Trevor who plays a critical role in the book. And when I first wrote the scene with Trevor, I want it to be like he loses the ring. That's a bad thing. But he loses it in the worst possible way. He loses it to an orangutan. And he has to go get it back. And I envisioned that as a funny slapstick scene. So I had an orangutan named Trevor. But then the more I wrote about Trevor, and I did some research into orangutans, what they're like, and physically what they're like, and emotionally what they're like. And I got into Trevor, and he became more – he kind of worked his way into the plot, and he became a critical character and even a little bit of a romantic lead at some – I mean, he falls in love with two women in the story.
Okay. So when they're going to Primate Encounter, and I assume you've seen places like Primate Encounter and something.
We have a lot of roadside attractions in Florida, and this Primate Encounter is based on kind of all of them.
You set that up very early on by having the snake guy need to go out there at some point. Does that mean that when you decided, okay, I'm going to have the orangutan, you went back and had the snake guy run off to that place?
That's absolutely correct. That is how that happened. You know, when I thought, okay, how would the ring get there? How would he, you know, how would the suitcase get to this place? The suitcase with the ring in it, how would it get there? You know, what would have been the mechanism for that? And then Dwayne became more important because I needed him to – he's a snake guy who also works in Primate Encounter. He's an all-around animal guy. And he is based very loosely on a guy I happen to know in South Florida who is the guy you call when there's an alligator in your swimming pool or, you know, a python in your yard.
But Dave Barry, okay, so you've got all these disparate elements. You're tying them in knots and knots and knots. At any time are you saying to yourself – oh, my God, what the hell am I doing? How am I going to get out of this mess?
You always have that. And because I like, you know, P.J. Woodhouse-ian plots. I like with lots of people going on, lots of people working across purposes. And it's sooner or later you come to a point where you've created a problem. You need a way out of it. And then that's why the beauty of it is you can go back and rewrite a scene or add a character or change something. But that's, to me, like more than 50% of writing a book is working through plot issues so that there's – I mean, not, you know, plausible is probably not the best word to use, but plausible in the context of the book. Once you've, you know, sort of bought into what I've told you so far, you're in for that much. You buy it the rest of the way. I don't want to have it suddenly become really stupid, you know, midway through.
If it does, hopefully somebody, your editor, will tell
you
that you've gone too far.
Although, you know what, I talked to I think it was Tony Hillerman. Was he the one who did the Navajo novels once?
Yeah.
When I wrote my first novel, Big Trouble, and I was a huge Tony Hillerman fan, and I was at the Maui Writers Conference, and he was there. And I went up to him, and I said, Mr. Hillerman, you know, I love your books. I've just written my first novel. And we ended up talking about it, and I brought up this issue. I said, like, here's my big fear, that I have made some huge plot error, and, you know, and nobody noticed it. You know, the editor didn't notice it. I didn't notice it. Nobody was going to see it. And then it's going to get out there. And he said, I'll tell you a story. He said, I wrote a book. It was a detective novel, you know, early in my career. And, like, the book comes out, and a guy comes up to me at a reading and says, you know, in this scene, here's what I don't understand. And it was something like, how did the gun get here when it was over there? You know, and Hillerman says, like, I went like, oh, my God, he's right. I didn't explain that. It makes no sense at all. And he said, and I thought, like, I was going to get thousands and thousands of letters about that. He said, that was the only guy who ever noticed that.
Well, you know, there's the famous Chandler story about the, I think it was in The Big Sleep, where the chauffeur is killed, and we don't know who did it. And you know how they found out? They found out when someone was writing the screenplay.
The screenplay, yeah. That is right. When you have a book made into a movie, the screenwriter always reads it really carefully because he's trying to figure out all the nuts and bolts of it. And that's when they'll find it, you know, and up to that point. Because readers generally, they're very generous about stuff like that. They don't read looking for mistakes. They go along with you, you know.
Right.
How many times have you read an action novel or whatever, just preposterous coincidences and so on, and you just let it go because it's fiction.
Well, who wrote the screenplay for Big Trouble? Was that you or someone else?
Oh, no, I didn't write it.
Did they call you up and say, hey, listen, how does guy from get from point A?
No. They didn't. I mean, because it wasn't like that was not a plot-intensive book, really. Not intricate, anyway. They never had anything like that.
But for this one, you kind of had to make sure that it all worked out, that you would know where the two creeps who took the Haitian were, and you had to know where everybody was at the exact moment.
Yeah, you know what I was thinking of was P.G. Wodehouse. You know, I love the Blanding's Castle stories, and, you know, where all that stuff is going on. And I remember reading that he used to have, you know, like timelines up on his wall, have it all, you know, organized. This was like that, like planning a farce where, you know, somebody comes in the door just as somebody goes out the door and all has to work out.
That gets me thinking, Dave Barry, when you say farce, I think of plays. Do you ever think about doing a play?
No.
Why not?
I just find it hard enough to write novels. I always think there's got to be some specialized skill, although I have now written a screenplay, and I'm working on, I mean, I've been commissioned to, and I don't know that it's that different, but I just know that there has to be, there's more skill involved than it looks like. You know, you think basically, when you're a novelist, you think, oh, screenplays, it's like a novel without, you know, with none of the description. How hard can that be? But then you start to do it, and you say, you know, there's a lot of skill involved in getting across economically the story in ways whereas in a novel, you have, like, pretty much an infinite amount of space. You don't when you're writing a screenplay. So I'm sure that writing an actual play for the stage has its whole set of parameters and rules, and I'm too old to start learning that stuff, I think.
One of the joys of reading Insane City for me was that here was a comic thriller novel, and we didn't see any mafia. It was so nice.
You know what? There actually are no bad guys in this. There are a couple of kind of shady characters, and there's some people you wouldn't really want to be friends with, but nobody ever kills anybody. Nobody's really evil. Everybody's, like, trying to do something, sometimes venal reasons, sometimes good reasons, sometimes selfish reasons. But there's really no bad guy.
Well, the ante isn't up, so there's no point where someone's life is in danger. And that's kind of, at this stage of the game for me, it's kind of refreshing.
Yeah. The biggest threat is that this poor Haitian woman will get sent back to Haiti. And even that would not be, you know, life-threatening to her.
Did that just wind up that way? Or did you always have a sense of your back of your mind that you weren't going to make it that kind of thriller?
Purely just personally, I wanted it to be kind of a happy book. You know, that where it just, you know, because I knew I had enough of a serious plot in the middle of it, which is really, you know, the relationship between the bride and the groom and will the wedding come off or not. And Seth has to go through a kind of a transformation. And I liked all that stuff. But I didn't want it to become suddenly about, because you know, the truth is in our lives, we don't usually have to make life and death decision. So I wanted to feel like this could happen to real people. That I wanted to give it that feeling and not just have it suddenly have to turn violent.
Well, the other thing is that in our politically disturbed environment, the idea of being able to create comedy in a long form without having to rely on anything except the mildest form of satire, it's pretty hard.
Comedy is hard anyway, and to make it be funny but still have some kind of heart to it. That was my biggest challenge, because in previous books, I've always gone purely for comedy, and they have been violent. And I kind of feel that was a mistake somehow, you know, that's kind of an easy thing to reach for. So I really wanted it to be like a gently funny book. I mean, it's got some crudeness and stuff, but it basically, I wanted you to like everybody in the end and be okay, happy with the way it came out and still care somehow.
Which is kind of difficult because it's very easy to create a villain.
That's the thing. And that's kind of when you think about a lot of fiction, and again, I have been guilty of this. I don't even mean it's a crime. It's not a crime. It really makes it easier to have a plot if you have somebody who's just bad, you know. And very rarely is there an explanation for why he's bad in any kind of fiction. People are just bad, and they want to kill, and they want to hurt, and they want to maim, you know. Many, many genres, that's kind of the whole basis of it. There's really horrible bad people, and we have to fight them and so on. Life doesn't work that way, you know. Like,
right.
You know, meet a lot of people you don't like in life, and you know there are bad people out there somewhere, but it's not really usually part of your... You don't go to work and face, like, evil, and, you know, your boss is not necessarily evil. He's, like, just your boss, and he's an idiot, and you don't like him. But he's not trying to ruin the world and, you know, enslave people. And this is so many of the things that are, you know, fundamental parts of plots of most books.
When you've got your plot, you are looking at comedy. I know that Dave Barry's thing, which is not that original, Gail Collins does it, is the repetition of a phrase, an event, something each time, building a little bit different and coming back to it. And you do it beautifully in that essay on summing up 2012.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you do it quite a bit. Is that on the rewrite, or is that just happening?
I'm not much of a rewriter. I'm a hours on a sentence kind of writer. Generally don't go past a sentence until I really like it. I spend a long time on every sentence, slowly. And part of that is just thinking about how am I going to use this later on? How am I going to come back to it? What's the best way to set it up?
Were there any little things that you put in there that you might use and then chose not to use?
Oh, yeah. No specific examples coming to mind, but every time I write a work of fiction, it's like what I was saying earlier about not knowing which characters are going to be.
Right.
You often think, okay, I'm going to use this later on, and then it turns out you didn't need to use it later, so you have to go back and take it out. There's a lot of that, really, now that you mention it, a lot of that in writing.
Dave Barry, let's move on for a second here to Peter and the Starcatchers. This is a prequel to Peter Pan.
Correct. Ridley Pearson, who writes thrillers, and I were in them for a long time in a rock band called the Rock Bottom Remainders, founded by the late, great Kathy Goldmark of San Francisco. Ridley and I became buddies over the years, and about 10 years ago, the Remainders were playing in Miami, and he was staying at my house, and he said, I was reading Peter Pan to my daughter, she was 6 at the time, and she stopped me and said, how did Peter Pan meet Captain Hook in the first place? And he thought, I don't know how, I don't know how that happened. So, he's in Miami. He said, I'm thinking that could be a book, a prequel to Peter Pan. And I said, that's a great idea. That really is. And he goes, well, do you want to write it with me? Because he had never written a children's book, and neither did I. And so we said, well, okay, we'll take a stab. We didn't have a publisher, and we both thought it would be one book, maybe 100 pages tops, for kids' book. And we ended up writing this book called Peter and Starcatchers. It was over 500 pages. It did really well. It was a bestseller. And then we ended up writing 5 of these books all together, so all leading up to the Peter Pan story.
Could there be more, or are you pretty much over?
No, we wrote every possible thing. our prequel is done.
How did that become a Broadway show?
It was kind of really strange. I mean, in La Jolla, there's a thing called Page to Stage, where they pick a work, a book, and they turn it into a play, and they do it as sort of a workshop. The audience comes in, watches the performance, and they have the audience stay. The director gets on stage and say, what did you like? What didn't you like? What didn't you understand? They take notes. They rewrite scenes, and they put it on the next night, differently. And they picked Peter and the Starcatchers. The guy who wrote it is Rick Ellis, who wrote Jersey Boys. And he took our book, and he radically changed the concept. The story is the same, but he made it into this extremely funny, very witty, a lot of wordplay, aimed at adults much more. It's very hard to describe, but basically you have 12 characters, 11 men and one woman, and they play like 50-something characters. So one minute you're a door, the next minute you're a tree, the next minute you're the lead character in a scene. And it changes very quickly and very minimal props, but they use things very creatively. Anyway, it's fantastically entertaining. They went to La Jolla, that worked. They went off Broadway, it worked, and they went on Broadway, and it won 5 Tony Awards. So it did really well. I'm praising it because I didn't do it. I'm praising Rick Ellis because he did an amazing thing.
It closed on Broadway and now is reopening off
Broadway.
And this is going to be a film of it. Is Christian Borle going to be in the film?
It's tragically no. Christian Borle plays the Black Stash, we call him. This is prequel to Peter Pan, so he doesn't have a hook yet. Or as my joke always was, you can't call him Captain Hand, right? And Christian Borle played Black's Mustache in the most – it's a combination of Groucho Marx and Cyril Richard and just completely over-the-top performance, brilliantly funny, just stole the show every night, and it just was wonderful. Then he had to go back off and be in Smash, unfortunately. But I doubt that he would be the Black Stash character in the movie because the movie's going to be based more in the book, which is much more – kind of a standard, adventure story for kids would be a more realistic pirate.
Do you know who's writing the screenplay?
Yeah, the guy who, I'm going to screw his name up. He's the guy who's directing it. I think his name is Gary Ross, who directed The Hunger Games. So he's a big director. He wrote the screenplay. And so that's why I think it might get made into a movie, because this is the guy with a lot of juice, you know what I'm saying?
Dave Barry, you and Carl Hiaasen both write crazy novels about Florida. And insane city is Miami. And we know from several elections that...
just want to say on behalf of Florida, please take away our electoral votes. Just take them. Distribute them among the other states that know how to use them.
Why is Florida so nuts?
It is not a serious place. I mean, Miami is sort of the epicenter of the non-seriousness. But when you think about why people go to Florida, they go there to retire, so they don't figure to work. They're not going there to build careers or anything. Get out and relax. A lot of people come just to party. There's, you know, some people come just running away from, you know, regular places, regular jobs. You've got many, many cultures, especially in South Florida. They're living in the same area, but they're not really communicating that much. In other words, we have a, you know, a huge Haitian community, which doesn't really have much to do with the huge Cuban community, which doesn't have much to do with the huge Argentinian community, the Brazilian community. Then there's a whole lot of European expats there. And then they got all, you know, the retirees. So it's like all these different groups kind of living around each other and continuing to do whatever they did wherever they came from, including drive. My line is that everybody's still driving according to the laws of his individual country of origin. There's no sense of we're all in this together. You know, we're proud of our community. None of that is going on, especially in Miami. Then you have the wildlife. You know, we have giant snakes and we have monkeys running loose and alligators in the streets and, you know, crabs on our lawns. It's just like not normal. And it's hot and it's humid and it's just this festering stew of weirdness, and just weird things keep happening there.
I remember visiting my grandmother in the 70s, and my Uncle Sol, who was 96 at the time, and he drove. And, you know, it was a little scary going across one of the causeways. And he said to me, oh, don't worry about it, because if we hit anybody, it'll be fine. Nobody uses insurance. We just give each other money.
I have the senior citizen drivers. I have a friend who's an ophthalmologist, and he was telling me one night, he says, these people come into my office. You know, I do the test, and I go, how did you get here? And they go, I drove. He said, you can't drive. You can't see. You must not drive. He said, I'm telling you, I give these people a test. I know they can't even see their own dashboard. But you also have the couples where the man is always driven because he's the driver, and the woman is always sat next to him. Well, he's completely blind now, but he's still the driver, and she's like next to him going, Harry, the lights, it's red, red. No, now it's green, green. It's an arrow. Harry, there's an arrow. She's like directing him which way to go.
Well, I keep thinking in terms of the politics. If life is so insane in Florida, then the politics – from us, we see something, but what's going on in Florida must be somewhat different because everybody's crazy.
Also, you know, everybody has very specific interests that have nothing to do with each other. Nobody says, what would be good for the state of Florida? You know, you have a large number of people who think the most important thing we can do in the state of Florida is boycott Cuba. We have people who think the most important thing we can do for the state of Florida is make sure senior citizens get, you know, whatever. So there's just like these very insular groups, and there's just no cohesion to the community.
Well, then it would seem that someone like Jeffrey Loria should own the Miami Marlins.
Oh, he's the worst owner, and everyone hates him. You know, we built him this stadium, this beautiful stadium, and he put his horrible team in it. You know, and it's getting worse now. He's got rid of, like, you want to come to Florida, you could play for the Marlins, you know. Bring your glove, you can play.
I love the fact that he hired Ozzie Guillen.
Yeah.
You know, you knew within 10 minutes Ozzie would say something.
Ozzie brilliantly chose to praise Fidel Castro. in a stadium that's just been built in the middle of Little Havana. That was brilliant. But that's, you know, typical Florida.
And of course, you have the other team, the Rays, who stopped being the Devil Rays because of fundamentalists, I think, in Tampa, which is right outside of there, the Scientologists.
Clearwater is like, I think it's Clearwater.
And nobody goes to the Rays games, even though they're one of the best teams in baseball.
Nobody goes to the Rays games. Nobody goes to the Marlins games. Just nobody goes to these games. The sports – and in Miami, like, the only team that's kind of popular really consistently, predictably, is the Dolphins. Right now the Heat are because they're winning. They're the national champions. But if they were to lose, you know, for a couple of seasons, nobody would go to see them. We don't have any team loyalty. Because it's, again, getting back to nobody's really from there. Nobody feels this loyalty to the place. If you mock Miami, everybody in Miami goes, yeah, you're right. Because people always say to me, don't you get in trouble? No, because everybody kind of agrees with me. I say, Miami's crazy. It's crazy.
There have been two TV shows, Miami Vice and Dexter.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Well, Miami Vice, when I got to Miami, it was right around the time of Miami Vice. I got there in the early 80s. You know, the cocaine wars were still going on. And the big concern on the part of the Chamber of Commerce and the city fathers was the image of Miami as a violent, dangerous place riddled with drugs and crime. You know, they kept trying to say it wasn't. They wanted to be more like Orlando. And then what saved the city was this TV show that comes along, and what does it say? It's a dangerous, violent place riddled with drugs and crime. But that's cool, you know? So suddenly Miami realized, and it's still true today, we're not Orlando. You know, we're never going to be the family-friendly, cute play. We're going to be a place where there's excitement, there's a hint of danger and intrigue, and it's just, you know, that exotic thing of that. That's what makes Miami popular. It's still a very popular tourist destination. It's just not a place where people come to have a family vacation.
Miami Beach went through all of its decline and fall, and then the rise. Where is Miami Beach now?
Oh, God. South Beach is, you know, you go, it's hot. There's clubs. There's all these people with breast implants walking around, kind of half-naked tourists everywhere you look. It's a party place. It's a great big party place, but it's booming over there.
They have managed, I guess, to create laws to protect the buildings because the...
Oh, yeah, they say, yeah. Well, that was really the gay community. When I got there, all those buildings on Ocean Drive, which are beautiful buildings, all those old hotels, but they were built in the 30s. They were dilapidated. All the plumbing was old. Everything was falling apart. And sitting in front of them were elderly Jewish, you know, retirees in aluminum folding chairs.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, you know, cooking on hot plates. And then, you know, there were the Marielitos, the recent wave, the poor Cuban immigrants who were there. And that was it. That was South Beach. And they were going to raise all of those old hotels and build condos. And it would have been horrible. It would have been disastrous. But that's what they wanted to do. But largely was the gay community in South Beach said, these are beautiful buildings. We're going to save them and we're going to fix them up. I mean, it wasn't just the gay community, but there was a lot of that. And they did it. They saved it. And now, you know, the idea, you can't touch those buildings. You know, it's one of the most amazing cityscapes there is, right there on the Atlantic Ocean, those beautiful buildings with the palm trees. So that has really turned that area around.
Dave Barry, you also did a TV show, Dave's World. You didn't have that much to do with it, did you?
I had total creative control over what I did with the check that they sent me for every episode. But no, I didn't write him. I was on one. I flew out to L.A. once and was in one episode. It was written by, you know, writers in Los Angeles, based very loosely on books and columns I'd written. But really, after a little while, they were on their own. They were just... I was a character in their world. Meanwhile, I was back in Miami writing my column, having my actual life. And it was strange to have this fictional day, Barry, being depicted out there.
Did people come to you and say, did this happen to you, things like that?
Yeah. People believed that I was writing it, and I don't know how I would write it while I was writing my column, or that it actually reflected my life. And I kept saying, no, it's really nothing like my life. It's a little strange.
Dave Barry, are you working on any novel now?
No. You mentioned I wrote a collection of essays called I'll Mature When I'm Dead, and my next book will be another collection of original essays, so I'm going to switch to nonfiction and then go back to another novel. That's my plan.
How do you like writing nonfiction compared to fiction, you think?
I like them both. I really do. The challenge with fiction is pretty much what you've been asking me about, all the stuff about making the story work, and I love to do that, but I really also like to write essays where you're kind of free. You don't have to worry about anything but what you want to say and what you think. Just trying to make it funny. So I've been collecting things to write about, and now I'm ready to write them.
Well, when you say you've been collecting things to write about.
My daughter's going to have a bat mitzvah. My wife is Jewish. I myself am not, but I'm nothing. But my wife is Cuban Jewish. Juban, they call them. And so our daughter, Sophie, has been raised Jewish, and she's going to have a bat mitzvah. And that is pretty entertaining, especially if you're not Jewish, to kind of be let in on the whole planning process for the bat mitzvah and who's going to sit where and then this. So anyway, I do definitely intend to write an essay about that. I'll have to wait till it's over, that kind of thing.
You've been listening to an interview with Dave Barry, whose latest novel, a comic novel, is titled Insane City. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.